Welcome back to the SCBWI podcast. I'm your host, Theo Baker. And on today's show, I'm very pleased to welcome the author and illustrator, Eugene Yelchin. Eugene is the author and illustrator of genre-bending illustrated novels and picture books like Breaking Stalin's Nose, Arcady's Goal, and 2021's The Genius Under the Table. His innovative books have won Newbery Honors and Golden and Crystal Kites. Born and raised in Soviet St. Petersburg, where he was a set and costume designer, Eugene emigrated to the States in the 1980s, where he went to film school at USC and worked in advertising and character design until winning SCBWI's Tommy DePaola Illustration Award in 2006 and began a serious pursuit of making books of the highest quality for children. Eugene's books are about tricks of vision and memory and morality and language, about shattering comfortable visions and norms and putting them together anew, and yet still standing before simple and clear things while being totally puzzled. They reproduce the process of growing up and acclimating to new surroundings without ever losing that sense of mystery and confusion and of being an outsider. I had a fascinating and wide-ranging talk with Eugene about post-war film, about making audiences uncomfortable, crushing your characters, collage, forgeries, Photoshop, fascism, humanism, black humor, and the beautiful arrogance of youth. I hope you enjoy. But before we talk with Eugene, I have a quick question. Have you registered for the 2024 Winter Conference in New York City yet? Listen, I'm about to talk with an award-winning author and illustrator who broke into the industry at this very event. It's from February 9th to the 11th, and registration is still open. Find out more about the conference at scbwi.org/annual-events. Okay, let's get to the show. I've read probably 90% of your books. When I was looking into you, one of the things I noticed is that you were a film student. You came out of USC. I'd love to hear about what drew you to film before we get into books.
Certainly. I have two educations. I have one that I received in Russia, where I'm from. I'm from St. Petersburg, and I went to what's called the Theater Arts Academy, and I was a stage designer and a costume designer there. And then when I came to the United States, I was truly and I was fairly successful. I mean, I worked in for the best theaters there, for the biggest theaters there. But when I came to the United States, I was convinced that I'll continue to be a theater designer. And of course, I didn't know anything. I didn't know the state of theater in the United States, and I couldn't speak the language. And it's a collective art, really. You don't do it by yourself. So that quickly disappeared. But films and cinema, rather, played a very important part, in fact, in my decision to leave the country, to leave Russia I left in 1983, but I think the first American film that I saw, I must have been between 7 and 10, something like that. I mean, we saw very old, and I write about it in my memoir, we watched really, really old Hollywood movies from the 1930s with German subtitles, because they were just a loot that the Soviet army took out of Germany after World War II. They kept them in this called Cinematographers Fund, I think it was called, in Leningrad then. And so my brother and I would go and we watched those movies, you know, all the sort of the classic American movies that the Germans bought and played in their movie theaters, and the prints were pretty trashed by then, you know. But I didn't really care so much about the genre of the film or the story that much. What was fascinating is to see the world, to see America, even though, you know, to us it was real. Whether it was Fred Astaire musical or John Ford Western, I had no idea, you know. So we were looking at America more than anything else. And compared to what surrounded us, it was so exotic. And to a young kid, it's just opened up imagination. And so I carried that sort of gratitude and love for cinema throughout my life. And I ended up finally at the graduate film program. And I made films there, and I made films afterward. I met my wife there at USC. And we both completely crazy about cinema, which is seemed to be disappearing in the United States, at least, in a way that to us, to my generation at least, it was an important cultural element of our lives. Everybody watched the certain movies and everybody talked about them. It was very important. It's obviously not important now, so it's in a way, but we still dearly love it. And our kid has started making movies, and he's very talented, I think. He's doing an amazing job. My wife teaches film. I teach screenwriting, and I teach an animation department here at LMU. And that love kind of stayed with us.
Absolutely. You're talking to a former film student as well. It's tragic what they've done to the art form, and to watch the art form devolve in front of our eyes when there were so many wonderful films. Your books are very filmic, and they have a kind of dream quality of the best films. You wrote about that so beautifully in your memoir about going and watching the films, and also the Bone Records, which as a former record collector, I'd always heard the stories about the Bone Records. What kind of films inspired you and moved you besides the kind of American Hollywood studio films that you got to see as a child growing up?
Well, that's a good question, and it's an enormous question, to be frank. You know, because our youngest son is 17 now, and so we have a projector, right? So we started rewatching the movies that both my wife and I really love and saw many, 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 many times, and showing it to him, right? And it's really astonishing to see a film that the last time I watched, maybe 20, 30 years ago, to see how much, and both, I spoke to Mary, to my wife about that, and we both share exactly the same feeling, is to, when we watch those movies, to realize how much our art today is influenced by them. Mm. And, we were watching, for example, Federico Fellini, and we watched, and my son is really particular. He watches every director in chronological order. So we were on Knights of Cabiria that night, you know. He watched like four previous films, and then we were on Knights of Cabiria. Our next one is going to be La Dolce Vita and so forth.
Yeah.
But watching Knights of Cabiria, watching Godard, watching French New Wave, watching Italian Neorealism, watching kind of post-war cinema, European cinema, and we didn't even get into like the 70s yet, but watching sort of like late 50s right now, it's extraordinary the impact that you carry through your life without realizing it, really. Like, and it comes out in your art and you don't even know it. That's very interesting to me.
Yeah. No, and I see it, and I see a lot of like that post-war, a lot of the post-war films you're talking about in your books, and the playfulness of that cinema when they were exploring the boundaries of what the rules were and rebelling against the Hollywood system. And
that's,
I see
true. That's true. You have, excuse me to interrupt. That's absolutely true. You are right. I think what was natural back then now is almost exotic. It's the sense of kind of humanism in those films. Is the really deeply felt understanding of the value of human life. you know, right after a horrific nightmare that occurred in Europe and in the East, I mean, all over the world, that war, that World War II, people would just wanted to make a little bit different, more kind of hopeful, more art that was humanistic, right?
Yeah.
And you know, so far, knock on wood, we were lucky. Our generation was lucky that we didn't experience it. Our parents did. My father did. My wife's father did. And it was very different generation than ours. And now the generations are different than ours still. And so the kind of this sense that human life is, you know, I don't want to be banal, but it's something that's the most important thing. And it seems that that feeling is slightly dulled by now. And I don't know what exactly that means, even though, you know, kind of horrific events are occurring today and we're watching them every day. And this, and there's no, you know, kind of no stability. We can't take anything for granted anymore, not only abroad, but also here. And so I think that is really important to bring that back if we can, to kind of think about it. You know, when Faulkner received his Nobel Prize, and he was, and his speech was very short, and I like to read it and reread it, because he said that the only thing is worth writing about is a human heart in conflict with itself. And I think we kind of forget about this, that this is really what it's about. It's about us. It's about contradictions in our character. It's about who we really are, and that in terms of craft, if you want to talk about that, if you want to reveal a character in any way, you have to put that character under tremendous stress in the critical. Right. So how the person behaves under stress is what who we really are. So I see a very different attitude in my students, for example, right now, because they may be very talented, but culturally, it's not acceptable to them to be uncomfortable. Mm. And when they say, oh, you know, like I was showing them a movie and half of my class wasn't looking at the screen, and I asked them why, and they said, well, it's gross. We didn't want to look at it. And okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But the thing is that you have to make yourself uncomfortable. You know, the art is not to make people comfortable. Art is to make people think about themselves and about others and about their place among others and how to treat other people. And yeah. and I feel like it kind of is getting away from us a little bit. It seems to me that it's kind of indicated in the books and in other forms of entertainment, the word which I kind of don't like particularly, but in the art, you know, and I think it's a big mistake too, because if you're, you know, you have to be out of your comfort zone to feel, and if we want to make art that makes people feel, then we want to put them in a situation in which you have to be kind of mean to your protagonist. You have to be really sadistic. You know, you have to put your protagonist through real, real hell in order to reveal the character and to put your reader in a position of, what would I do in that situation?
Right. Yeah. And what we like to imagine what we would do is often very different than what we would do in that situation, because we're also surrounded by, and I'm sure you know firsthand, to rebel against an overwhelming ideology, to kind of champion the human spirit, individuality is a complete rebellion. And especially in our times, we seem to be forgetting that human perspective of art. Anyways, I'm getting conceptual.
Good. Conceptual is good. That's what we are lacking, good concepts. So that's good.
But let's go back to breaking Stalin's nose a little bit. And I really think your work is singular in that you're making illustrated novels and memoirs and with drawings oftentimes on every page or several drawings on every page. I've been attempting to do that for the past couple of years. Oh man, it's a lot of work and it's difficult. And there's a lot of balancing the writing versus the illustration, and the illustration changes the writing, and the writing changes the illustration. And there's so many drawings. Tell me about how you decided or started to come up with the form that it would take, the shape that it would take.
Yeah, thank you for that, for asking this. This book is still read, which is quite amazing. And the reason, there were multiple reasons for it. One of them was because I was coming out, it was my first novel, middle grade novel. Prior to that, I only made picture books, so I was familiar with that format. But I think the real reason what drew me to combine the two languages, you know, the visual and the prose, was there were no books like that written before for children. It's the first book about Stalin for children. Since then, they would kind of open the door, which I'm very proud of. But there was nothing like this, and the reactions were different. The reaction was one in the United States. Then it came out in Russia a year later, and the reaction was very different. Stalin was becoming, under Putin, he was becoming once again a positive historical figure. Now it's turned already in a completely fascist state, but there are still people there, although most of them had to leave, you know, after the war started, still there, that are very brave and do very brave things. And I was worried that the book was the story itself and the world building of that story was so exotic to, because I was writing it for the American kids. I was lucky that it was translated in so many languages afterwards. But I was thinking, of course, about American kids, and it was so exotic to them that I felt that they need to see it. They need to, because visually, our kids, just because of technology, they may be a little bit better viewers than their readers sometimes. And so to have it in front of them, as far as just, you know, interiors, wardrobe, just kind of the material culture. So it doesn't feel like a sci-fi book or fantasy book, you know, so it feels real. So as a result, the illustrations are fairly real. You know, they're somewhat stylized, but they're fairly real. And then later on, I went on to, in other books, I went on to just making like photographic collages for kind of a similar reason.
Like in Spy Runner, those illustrations are so fascinating to me because they have the feel of being real and the feel of dust and texture and degradation, but they're not real.
They're not real. They combine out of them, they're collages essentially. They're combine of, you know, hundreds of pieces of photographs, old photographs, some of which I found, some of which I took myself, and then sort of combined into one image. And this is a book about fake photographs, really. I mean, conceptually, I felt that it would work. So you have to find, I think, if you make an illustrated book, not a picture book, that's totally different conversation to have. But if you decide to illustrate your book or have your book illustrated by somebody else, the form and the style of it has to express the world in which your heroes operate. And usually in good books or in good films or in good theater performances or whatever, anything that has a person in the landscape or in an interior, so to speak, there are certain rules to world building, which I teach too, that need to be studied. It's not random, in other ways. Where you put your characters, it's not random. It's thought out very clearly, and it has to be very clear to the reader that the world in which your protagonist operates makes it difficult for your protagonist to achieve the goal.
I want to come back to that in one second, but you said something earlier, which was turning over in my mind, which was your decision to kind of provide for Raking Stalin's Nose, the material language and the material culture. So it wasn't science fiction. And as someone, I grew up, I love Russian literature. I grew up reading Russian literature. And it always has had that kind of science fiction quality to me. When I read the books, right? I'll read and everyone has six different names, and it took me a long time to figure out the patronym system, and everyone has the diminutive name and the pet name and the inside name, and the name, especially books set in St. Petersburg, everything has an unreality to it. And then I remember I read lectures by Nabokov, who was saying, here's how they actually dressed. Here's what Anna Karenina looked like. Here was the style of clothes that she wore. It's strange to me to hear you say, well, I wanted to provide a level of reality. And so it didn't just go off into outer space.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because especially about St. Petersburg, because it's such a difficult place to actually tell. Actually, in a way, St. Petersburg is closer to our readers, to our younger readers now than we think it might be. And the reason for it is because people now are so much on social media, and some of it is difficult to tell whether it's real or not, right? So there's some confusion between reality and man-made images or woman-made images or whoever made that image, human-made images. And it's very similar because I grew up in a place which, when in 19th century, when people like Dostoevsky and Pushkin and Tolstoy and others later used St. Petersburg as a location, they would actually use real names and real street addresses. And I was born in a hospital which was two blocks away from the building in which Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment kills those two women. Mm-hmm. And so recently, well, not quite recently, but a few years ago, I saw this news item. I watch Russian TV because I want to see how one becomes a fascist.
Yeah.
And so there was a news item where a reporter goes into that apartment described by Dostoevsky. And now there's a young family lives there, a young woman and a young man, and they have a child. And the child's crib is approximately in the same location where the murder took place. And the reporter asks the couple, aren't you afraid, to live here and to have your kid here? And they say, no, it's fine. We don't feel anything. We don't feel anything. They talked about that as if it was an actual thing. It was a real thing. So St. Petersburg has this quality of confusing things that you read and part of your imagination with an actual location. And so it's so, and that fusion creates a kind of a city in which imagine and the real have no border, which is, I think, is very interesting for a forming artist who is in its formative years or at the beginning of one's career. And I think that influenced me a lot as well. It could not have, you know, definitely it was an influence on many, many different things and many different pieces of work that I've done. And even in Breaking Stalin's Nose, I refer to, you know, to a Gogol story and the title comes, it's a nose, right?
The nose, yeah. One of the great short stories of all time.
We all came out of Gogol's Overcoat. Overcoat is that, you know, his famous short story. And it's so true because this sense of kind of grotesque and yet humanism, the sense of dream, as you said earlier, like quality, partially because it's a city built on swamps. So the fog was certainly an element.
And the grids too, right? Like one thing that I remember reading in a lot of the translations that I would read growing up, they would abstract the names of the streets and change them in English to just numbers. Mm-hmm. Or almost like New York because of its construction. So for me, it had St. Petersburg has always had that kind of cloud that exists sometimes.
It's a very, very strange city. It's a beautiful city and I do miss it. I haven't been there since 1983 and I will never be there again. So it kind of lives in my head as a fantasy almost now, you know.
We've been talking with Eugene Yelchin. We've got plenty more coming up after the break. But in the meantime, be sure to check out Eugene's catalog of incredible books at his website, eugeneyelchin.com. I recommend pretty much everything. And have most recently been obsessing over his illustrations in The Assassination of Brangwaine Spurge, his collaboration with M.T. Anderson. Okay, let's get back to the show. Part two begins now.
I want to go back to what you were saying about setting up the contours of world building as a way to sort of, especially by establishing visual language, to press down on your character and make your character suffer, right, and push them to reveal what's inside of them. How do you think about that visually when you're coming up with the language for a book?
Well, the first thing to remember, there are several steps to it, and I can try to be as simple as I can. The visual world is the expression of your protagonist. It's a physical expression of who your protagonist is. And it's built according to a set of rules which are to make, which have built in opposition to your character's want. So there are two things, you know, to remember about each character, is that the character kind of walks on two legs. One leg is want and another leg is need. So the want is created from a problem of your story. You know, every story has some kind of conflict, some kind of problem that affects your protagonist, and your protagonist tries to solve it in the wrong way, usually. And that's the want. So that the line is your protagonist and your reader understand what the want is, you know, what the character wants. It's called, you know, it has a term for it called desire line, which you follow. That's what you follow. That's your plot, essentially, you know, how they try to solve this problem. But the other leg is need, and need really what it means. It means that we all have some weakness of character. We will have it. The problem is we often don't know it. And so we need to be put in a position in which we are exposed to it. Whether we change in the end, when we discover, it's not a psychotherapy. What happens is that you push yourself by trying to solve these problems that mounts up and get worse and worse and worse. And so the stakes get higher and higher and higher. And at some point, you begin to realize that, why can I solve all this problem? And so you start looking within yourself, and you start looking at yourself. So there's something that's holding me. There's a great American film called The Hustler, Paul Newman,
yeah.
And so he's told very clearly, in no uncertain terms, that you have to have two things. You have to have skill, and you have to have character. So you can be very skillful, but if you don't have character, and character in this particular case would be, to not just to work really hard, but people's reaction that's negative, rejection. And as an author, you get rejections, right? Yeah. And as an artist, your art is rejected all the time. Yeah. Not all the time, but very often. And so as a result of that, you have to have a character to withstand that, and to be strong enough, practice your skill, and try to develop a sense of strength of character. That's really, really important. And I think that it's very difficult, because we build this kind of walls around ourselves that protect us. And when you ask somebody, do you like this piece of art? And they say, no, I don't like it, for example. But they can't explain it. Yeah. And it seems to me that that's the case where people live in denial. So because when they can't say what's wrong with it, it usually means that they can't say what's wrong with them, that it causes them some kind of pain that they try to protect themselves from by not knowing.
Yeah.
And so I feel like my goal, because I write for very young readers, not very young, but for children. And so my goal is to not to be nice to them, not to be patronizing to them, not to make them feel good, not to come up with a happy ending that's unrealistic, but just be real, be authentic, and treat them with respect.
Yeah. One thing that I was thinking about as you were talking, there's a philosophical theory about, I think it's Henri Bergson, who says, we perceive in the world the things which have the potential to threaten us, to harm us. That's all we actually see. Or we see, lakes because it has the potential to quench our thirst for months. Is the idea that, because what I was thinking about as you're talking and setting up, your visual worlds and setting up the language of it to give us the feeling that in concert with the language that the character, the protagonist, is being pressed and challenged, the idea that you start to see the threats, the things that are going to come to hurt us, or is it not quite so one-dimensional in that way? Are we able to see things that are past our immediate or short-term survival math?
It depends. I think it's very individual. There's no one answer that will fit everybody. We have to keep in mind our audience, and our audience is young, and they don't know a lot of things. And the simplest, clearest things are sometimes so puzzling that they feel like a danger. They feel dangerous.
Yeah. Right?
So that puzzle we call life is the stuff from which the stories are made. And when you have a character who's young enough not to know everything, not to know themselves yet, not to know how things work in the world, not understanding certain words or many words, or not catching what people are talking about in the room with you. And for me, I experienced it twice. Once, when I was growing up in a country in which people just silence was the means of self-preservation. So you had to kind of twist the answers out of people, and nobody would talk to you about anything. And it was a long, long process for me to actually learn where I lived. And then the second time happened when I came to the United States, where I couldn't understand the language. And so I would be in a company of people and they'll be talking animatedly and excitedly. And I had no idea what was going on. And I could have been, 5 years old at that point. And so that feeling of sort of the puzzle is really, I think, interesting. And I hope it speaks to young readers. Because it's sort of kind of their experience, they enter this world that they make a lot of assumptions, especially young adults. Like my son is now, he's going to turn 17 in December, and everything is black and white, and passionately black and white.
Yeah.
Which makes for an artist at some point, which is good, he has very strong opinions. He doesn't doubt himself. So there's this arrogance of youth, which is exceptional and has to be treasured, simply because if I knew what I know now when I was 17 or 16 or early 20s, I wouldn't be able to make art the way I was making it. Mm. I mean, if my first show that I was part of, which I designed the sets and the costumes for, were for the biggest theater in Russia. And then it was played in the most sacred theater in St. Petersburg, which is in Hermitage. It's a Hermitage theater, which was the Romanovs family theater. It's a copy of 18th century Italian stage and auditorium. It's wood. And I would be so anxious if somebody asked me to do it now. But I didn't care. I was 20 or 21, and I was doing those things that I would not dare do now. Some of it also was just lack of knowledge. Even the theater academy that I went to, we did all kinds of things on stage there. And I had no idea that that was what called Tenishev's school before the revolution, where Nabokov was sitting, maybe at the same desk I was sitting. I had no idea. Mandelstam, the greatest Russian poet, went to that school. Mayakovsky spoke from that stage. I mean, there was all these things that we were not aware of. Yeah. Only now I know all of this, and I'm amazed that I was part of something much, much bigger than me. But I think it's in me, whether I knew it or not, whether I knew it or not. Because for example, just last thing I'll say, and then we can move on.
Sure, sure.
My teacher at the academy was the student of what's called the World of Arts, which is Diaghilev's magazine, Ballet Russe. So that connection is still with me. It didn't go anywhere. And you can see it I can see it in my paintings, maybe not in my books, but probably in my books too, because all of those guys were illustrators.
There's so much to think about in what you just said. And one thing that I was going over, I was thinking about growing up in a society where everyone is speaking in code, where everyone is speaking so as not to be understood, that everything had to be twisted out. And then here, where in America, where everyone just says, here's how I feel this way, but you not understanding that. I was just thinking about, like, what did you have to do to sort of free up your mind to be able to say what's on my mind, to not feel like there's somebody possibly listening, and not having to translate your thoughts into a subversive coded message in a way?
It took a lot of work to begin with, but also it's becoming increasingly, and that's a totally different subject altogether.
Yeah.
It's becoming increasingly difficult to exercise First Amendment from both sides of the aisle, from both. We are very divided right now, and we're adamant on being divided. It's very difficult to find a common language. We believe different things. We believe what we want to believe. It's all really cliche what I'm saying. Everybody understands that. But I think it's an issue.
Let me be more specific, because speaking of having limited common language, I wanted to mention the assassination of Brangwyn Spurge, your collaboration with Tobin Anderson, where there's a unity because it's all in one book, mm-hmm. but there's a couple different stories going on and sending coded messages, and no one seems to be on the same page. I'm so enthralled by these illustrations. I think they're just absolutely wonderful. I would just love to tell you about how I see them. I see them as these, they feel like oftentimes there are these different layers of kind of photocopying techniques. It feels as if they're kind of old plates from ancient books that have been resurrected somehow. And I look at these illustrations and they're just kind of dumbfounding to me. I'm just marvel at the different layers of textures, the different resolutions even. You know, sometimes like the jewel is so finely wrought and the lines behind it kind of start to blur and almost get photocopied into that kind of distort. There's layers of just, I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about, I don't want you to give away the store, but tell me a little bit about how these illustrations came to be.
Well, we made this book on the phone because Tobin is in Vermont, I'm in LA. And so we kind of talked every day and we came up with the story first. And then he was writing some chapters and I was making kind of a storyboard for the whole book. And I would send him a storyboard and he would send me a chapter and then we'll switch. And we went along like this and it didn't take us very long, but it was incredible fun because I don't know a more playful person than Tobin. I mean, he's simultaneously a genius and somebody who is so ready to play. That combination is very rare. And I absolutely adore him, you know, yes. As so many people are and should. I mean, he's our treasure. And so I'm very honored to have this collaboration. But in terms of illustrations, they're all actually drawn by hand, but in pieces. So I would draw several pieces for each spread. And then I would combine them in Photoshop and I would give them a very kind of very, I know very little about Photoshop to be a pro in it. So whatever I could come up with, I used. But of course, my inspiration was, I became kind of I was always sort of a fanatic of Gothic. I mean, I absolutely love late Gothic. And so Dürer and, you know, that type of etchings, I was just trying to reproduce that fine detail that they have and that attention to detail and to the form and to the shape. And also I had to tell a story. So it was not easy, but it was incredible fun. That's all I can say. It was probably the most fun I had making that book.
Well, I can imagine you saying, I can't wait till Mr. Anderson sees this one, right? I bet there is a little bit of that where you're like, I'm going to knock his socks off.
But it implies competition. And I don't think we were competing at all. We have very similar interests outside of children's literature.
Yeah.
And so we were mostly talking about that stuff. Mm. We were talking about ideology. He wrote the book about Shostakovich. We were talking about music. we were talking about Cold War, and this book is a result of those conversations. And plus, we were in a moment in our country which was very different. I don't think he had ever experienced anything like that. And I certainly know, not here.
Yeah. When you're developing the style or the materials or the process that you're going to use for a book, mm-hmm. I imagine there's a phase where you're just exploring and seeing what's fun or what works or what you want to do. At what point do you start to lock that down? And do you ever feel constricted by the rules that you set up for yourself when the actual illustration part of it begins, when the exploration part, part is over in terms of material or form?
Yeah, I understand. There is always this timeline when you have an image in your head and it's a beautiful ethereal image that you try to capture, and you do what you do, and then you look at it and you're in misery, right? You're miserable. Because it's absolutely nothing what you had in mind, but in what you have in front of you is just the beginning of the process, and then you start kind of working with it, and it may in the end up entirely different than what you intended, but you sort of discover things as you go along. I have sort of it's a difficulty, and yet it's a blessing. I can work in any style there is out there. You know, it doesn't matter to me whether I work in what material or in what style. I mean, I'm just, you know, because I'm an immigrant. I'm Zelig. I'm like imitator. You know, I can.
Yeah.
If I can say that, I'm a pretty good forger. So I can forge any style, and that's difficult. And so, yes, you have to create rules for yourself, because one thing that's going to hinder you greatly is freedom. Freedom is deadly for an artist. So you have to really set a very strict boundaries and limitations for yourself, because if anything goes, then anything goes. Then there is no unity of style, of thought, of material. And I guess I'm a purist. If I decide to go in a particular direction, I set up a very, very strong rules for myself that I cannot break. And sometimes when I break them, I'm surprised, and it's good. Of course, I leave it, you know, because I surprised myself. And if you surprise yourself, whether you write or illustrate, there's a good chance that your readers are going to be surprised. And that is gold to us, you know?
Yeah, I know from my own personal experience, it's very difficult to surprise yourself when you haven't set up those boundaries, especially you say, I'm working in, here are my rules. Let's see how I can kind of, what I can come up within them. And oftentimes, I don't know, for me, that creates that, you say freedom is bad, but it also kind of creates a freedom of saying, I'm stuck here. I might as well mess around inside of these rules.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, breaking rules is great, but you need to know the rules, you know, first. And we have really interesting examples of it, particularly in fine arts. You know, like Matthew Barney, the beginning of Matthew Barney's career, drawing restraint. When you are as talented and as extraordinary of an artist as he is, if he doesn't bound himself, then he needs really real obstacles in order to work. And so he creates the most insane obstacles for himself, because he started with a kind of the body art, and then he moved into those movies that he was making. And we have a great deal of writers who are multi-talented, right? But they stay within the theme. You know, they figure out what their theme is, who they are. And the theme is usually there's a lot of misunderstanding about the theme period. You know, I thought, to me, the theme is the way you see the world. It's really how to treat other people. That's the theme. So from that comes, you know, this is a protagonist and this is an antagonist, because they may want the same thing, but they go about it a different way. You know, I talk a lot about shadow, Jungian shadow, to my students, and to see that we carry both in us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to write antagonists. Mm. And the way an antagonist is, why antagonists are so much more interesting to kids than protagonists, because they break the rules, they do terrible things, right? And they get away with it for the most part.
Yes, they do.
And I think the role of an author is in direct parallel to the role of the antagonist. You create problems.
Mm. In creating problems for your own self as a working artist, are you ever satisfied if you're not working right on the border of your own limitations? I talked to Sean Tan about this, wonderful artist. What he said to me, which stuck with me, is that he said, if I'm on the right track, I feel kind of depressed about the work. If I feel too good about it, that means, you know, maybe it's too easy. I've learned to sort of live with feeling bad about the work, that it's not living up to what I need it to be. Are you comfortable making work where you're saying, you know, this is easy for me, or does it always need to feel challenging?
You know, I'd be completely honest with you. It's never easy to me.
Yeah.
It's every time, and I'm sure you've heard it from other people, every time we start something new, it's as if we've never done it before. To fall on your old tricks is to make something dead born. You know, yes, I have certain tricks that I use, that I know. I know certain rules that are very helpful. You know, when people ask me, sometimes I'm writing conferences, they say, what do you do when you have a writer's block? Well, I don't believe in writer's block. I don't even know what that means. Writer's block is when you don't know the structure. You know, when you know the structure, you know what probably should come next. You know, it can come in many different forms, but you know its function. And if you know its function, then you know what follows what and in what order. And what does it do? You know, if you know those kinds, it's like being a car mechanic. I mean, how is that different? You know how the thing works. And so you make sure that it runs. Car mechanic does not have, you know, car mechanic.
No car mechanic block.
Yeah, there's no such thing. Why should it be authors? You know, because there's this kind of romantic idea of channeling things. Well, I don't channel anything. I don't know how to channel things. I'm influenced by things, probably too much. But channeling, no, it all comes through my lens, no matter whatever I'm forging, right? No matter what I'm stealing all the time. No matter what it is, it has to go through the filter of who you are.
Lovely. All right. Do you have any, I'm not going to place any limitations on this question, but do you have any final thoughts for, I don't know, maybe even if you could talk to yourself as you were starting to make books, if there's anything that you would tell yourself, either maybe even to worry about or not to worry about, or, you know, if you could tap yourself on the shoulder, let's say in 2004, 2005. Yeah.
Well, I, you know, because I came from so many different fields, I had an idea of the process, even though the rules were different. I can say one thing only, and it's not something that I came up with, something that I spoke to a person who was very, very interesting person, and he said it, and then it proved, he was proven right again and again and again. And the thing is this. if something scares you on your page, that is where you go. You don't go away from it, you go into it. This is where, if you have a problem and that problem scares you, that has the answer. Don't go looking for answers elsewhere. Go deep into your fear, into that thing that scares you the most. And that's where your art is. That, I think, I don't know better way of putting it. Whatever scares you is what you can give to other people. That's your gift, is to keep staring at something that's really difficult to stare at, and stare and stare and stare and stare and go deeper and deeper and deeper. And you learn some about yourself, first of all, but you also will learn a lot about what you are making.
Thank you for that. This was just an incredibly fascinating talk.
It was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so, so much.
That's all the time we have today on our program. On behalf of all of us at SCBWI, I'd like to thank Eugene/Evgeny for making the time to talk with us. If you liked what you've heard, please subscribe to our totally free show and leave us some stars, if that's how you feel. Please head over to scbwi.org if you want to learn more about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. This episode was produced by Chelsea Kimiko Hall and edited by Samantha Thomas. And this podcast is made possible with support from the Authors Coalition of America. Thanks for listening this week, and we'll see you next week. So long.